Señor Calvani, señor presidente del Tribunal Gallego de Defensa de la Competencia, señores consejeros de dicho tribunal, señor consejero del Consejo de Contas, autoridades, señoras y señores. Hace apenas dos semanas nos visitaba el presidente de la Comisión Nacional de la Competencia, la Autoridad Española de la Competencia, y en aquella intervención había comentado cómo es consustancial a la naturaleza del hombre el ser libre y cómo también es una connotación de la naturaleza humana el ser social. El hombre es un ser social, es un zoon politikon, como decía Aristóteles, y de la combinación de esas dos cualidades, de la libertad y de la sociabilidad, surge indefectiblemente el derecho como norma, como conjunto de normas que garantizan y limitan las libertades individuales a fin de hacer efectiva la libertad, esa libertad en cada uno de los miembros de una comunidad. Y el máximo exponente de la libertad individual lo tenemos en el Estado social y de derecho, en el que el único imperio es el de la ley. Y dentro de las libertades individuales encontramos la libertad económica, la libertad de empresa, dentro de una economía de mercado, tal y como reconoce y protege nuestra Carta Magna en su artículo 38, imponiendo a los poderes públicos la obligación de promocionar y de proteger la libertad de empresa. Y así como la libertad individual encuentra su marco máximo de desarrollo en el Estado democrático, la libertad de empresa se manifiesta dentro de un escenario que se denomina el mercado. El mercado como instrumento que mejor o más eficientemente distribuye los recursos de los que dispone una comunidad. Así pues, a fin de que las libertades individuales y entre ellas la libertad de empresa puedan ser efectivas, los poderes públicos tienen que regular, tienen que limitar la libertad de empresa para que el mercado produzca los efectos beneficiosos que debe producir en la sociedad. En definitiva, es proporcionarle a la misma mayores y mejores servicios a un coste menor. Y en este sentido, el cambio gradual que se produjo a nivel mundial de la gestión directa de la economía hacia una confianza creciente en el mercado es hasta ahora la razón a la que más se recurre para explicar la expansión del derecho de la competencia en todo el mundo. La adopción de una ley de competencia ha sido inherente a las medidas de reforma económica en muchos países en vías de desarrollo. El derrumbe del comunismo, junto con la caída del Muro de Berlín en 1989, propició que la tendencia política de mercados más liberales se extendiesen a economías anteriormente planificadas de forma centralizada. La adopción de una ley de la competencia ha formado parte, pues, de la transformación jurídica de las economías de planificación centralizada hacia economías basadas en el mercado. La importancia creciente que se le otorga al derecho de la competencia como parte de las reformas económicas no se limita a Europa del Este ni mucho menos a los países en vías de desarrollo. La literatura actual también sugiere que la adopción de una ley de la competencia guarda estrecha relación con el desarrollo global de un país. En concreto, se sugiere que aumenta la preocupación sobre las prácticas comerciales restrictivas cuando los países avanzan más allá de la fase inicial del desarrollo de una economía industrial. Sin embargo, algunos podrían sugerir que la aplicación de las medidas antimonopolios debería minimizarse debido a la recesión económica. Estos creen que la competencia es, pues, una carga demasiado pesada de soportar cuando el mercado sufre. Pero no podrían estar más equivocados. La aplicación de las medidas antimonopolio es incluso más importante cuando los mercados retroceden, los precios suben y las oportunidades de mercado fallan. En primer lugar, la aplicación de prácticas restrictivas de la competencia será incluso más importante cuando la recesión económica lleve a algunas empresas a ir por el camino más fácil y establecer acuerdos con sus rivales. En segundo lugar, las empresas podrían intentar usar el contexto de crisis como justificación para fusionarse con la competencia en formas que no se hubiesen imaginado en una economía más sólida y más desarrollada. Esto supondría crear entidades con un poder de mercado excesivo que sobrevivan a la recesión. En tercer lugar, la tentación de las empresas dominantes de ganar cuotas de mercado excluyendo de forma ilegítima a los competidores podría ser mayor si lo ven como un atajo para mantener las expectativas de venta de los accionistas en momentos difíciles. Además, las claves para intervenir la recesión económica residen en aumentar la competencia. La aplicación de las normas antimonopolios puede representar, pues, un papel muy importante para eliminar las barreras y permitir a nuevas empresas entrar en el mercado, aumentando así las oportunidades de trabajo y promoviendo el crecimiento de la economía. La competencia efectiva, pues, potencia la innovación por parte de las empresas, promueve la adaptación de sus estrategias al mercado, del mercado a la demanda y de los clientes a las inversiones a largo plazo. La competencia y las normas de la competencia contribuyen así a una asignación eficaz y a un uso rentable de los recursos que son cada vez más escasos, como por ejemplo los energéticos, y de esta forma vemos cómo se contribuye a conservar el medio ambiente y se promueven las inversiones a largo plazo. Los beneficios de la competencia efectiva para la sociedad son, pues, los siguientes. Contribuye a crear las condiciones necesarias para el crecimiento a largo plazo de las empresas. Elimina la imposición privada, que es a lo que equivalen los precios que aplican las empresas protegidas de la competencia. Y, por último, proporciona a los consumidores el beneficio de obtener precios más bajos, más selección y mejor calidad, como habíamos dicho, de bienes y servicios. Aunque para algunos la aplicación de medidas antimonopolios debería minimizarse, como saben, el debate sobre la penalización de la aplicación del derecho de la competencia sigue abierto en el seno de la Unión Europea. El principal argumento de los que están a favor de la penalización de las prácticas graves de restricción de la competencia se basa en que la disuasión efectiva realizada únicamente a través de sanciones a las empresas significaría imponer sanciones muy altas que deberían complementarse con periodos de prisión para conseguir una disuasión eficaz. No voy a ser yo el que imparta la conferencia. Para eso tenemos hoy el honor de recibir en la escuela al señor Terry Calvani, experto en Derecho de la Competencia. Es un honor y una honra para esta institución que dirijo, tanto por la autoridad que le otorga su dilatada experiencia como por su actual desempeño profesional de la abogacía en los Estados Unidos. El señor Calvani ejerce en la actualidad como especialista de Derecho de la Competencia en la firma de abogados Freshfields, Brookhouse and Deringa, en su oficina de Washington. Fue, con anterioridad, miembro y presidente de la Federal Trade Commission, que es la autoridad norteamericana de la competencia, y miembro de la autoridad irlandesa de la competencia. Director de la División de Cárteles Criminales, en la actualidad el señor Calvani en aquel periodo participó, perdón, como miembro activo en diversos comités consultivos de la Dirección General de la Competencia de la Comisión Europea. Después de graduarse en la Facultad de Derecho de la Universidad de Cornell en el estado de Nueva York, en la cual colaboró como editor para la revista Law Review, trabajó para Pillsbury Medicine and Sutro, y de 1973 a 1983, el señor Calvani fue profesor de Derecho de la Competencia en la Vanderbilt School of Law. Tras su periodo en la Comisión Federal de Comercio, ejerció de nuevo en el sector privado con las compañías Pillsbury hasta que fue nombrado para el cargo que desempeñó en Irlanda. Además, ejerció como profesor en la Vanderbilt School of Law, impartió clases de la competencia en la Duke University School of Law, en la Harvard School of Law y en el Trinity College de Dublín. También ha sido profesor en la Cornell Law School, la Facultad de Derecho de la Universidad de Cornell. Ocupó el señor Calvani cargo de presidente de diversos comités de sección de la competencia de la American Bar Association, que es la Asociación de Colegios de Abogados Norteamericanos. Durante dos trimestres formó parte del Consejo de Dirección de la misma. Es miembro del American Law Institute y colabora en el Comité Consultivo del Antitrust Bulletin. El señor Calvani escribió y ha pronunciado conferencias relacionadas con la competencia. Además, se menciona como importante abogado en la competencia y regulación en muchos manuales y directorios recientemente fue nombrado como uno de los 20 principales abogados de la competencia en el mundo en la revista Who is Who, publicada por la Law Business Research. En el periodo que ejerció en el sector privado, el señor Calvani trabajó en adquisiciones y en participación de empresas, así como en su supervisión por parte de numerosas agencias de la competencia. Participó en investigaciones civiles y penales en muchas empresas, tanto de autoridades federales como estatales, y asimismo proporcionó asesoramiento en materia de la competencia a un gran número de empresas y numerosas asociaciones de comercio. Sea pues bienvenido, señor Calvani, a esta escuela. Es un alto honor, repito, recibirle en la misma. Siéntase en casa y considérese un miembro activo de la misma, un profesor de la misma. Nada más, muchas gracias. Tiene la palabra el señor Calvani.
Muchas gracias, señor Figueroa, y mil gracias a ustedes por su invitación. Mi esposa Sara y yo siempre hemos querido visitar a Galicia y estamos encantados de estar aquí. Santiago es una ciudad maravillosa, fantástica. Cuando mi amigo Pablo, hijo de Don Pablo, y un alumno mío hace 5 o 6 años en Cornell University, cuando Pablo me invitó a venir aquí, él me dijo que podría hablar en inglés o en español. Con disculpas, voy a hablar en inglés. De lo contrario, aun suponiendo que me entendieran, tardaría todo el día en presentarles mis observaciones. Les aseguro, es mejor que hable en inglés. Thank you once again for your very gracious introduction. It was an introduction that only I thought my mother could write. Before beginning, I want to note that I have made available to the school an article that my son and I did on this general subject for an Australian audience. I've made it available here in Spanish because while it's not what I'm going to say today, it does contain a more developed exposition of my remarks today. And so if you're interested in the subject matter, the longer paper may be of assistance to you, and it is translated into Spanish. I warn you in advance that paper is a sure cure for insomnia. Now, focusing on my subject, most countries with competition laws prescribe cartel conduct. Almost all of them, make cartel conduct illegal. Maybe all of them. Only a minority, however, treat price fixing and related conduct as a crime. The few countries that do so are Brazil, Canada, Estonia, Ireland, Israel, Korea, Japan, Russia, the United States, the United Kingdom, and most recently, Australia. And today, what I should like to consider is whether criminal penalties are necessary to adequately deter cartel behavior, or whether monetary sanctions, like fines or private damages, might be sufficient to deter. In doing so this morning, I am going to focus exclusively on deterrence, and I'm going to admittedly ignore other issues that might arise under community law or the law of the member states as to whether criminal penalties could legally be imposed. So the only question that I'm addressing is whether or not criminal sanctions are necessary to deter cartel behavior. I'm not going to address issues of criminal competence. Now, before addressing the question of deterrence, I want to take with you a very brief world tour to review the various jurisdictions that proscribe criminal conduct. So let's go around the world and see what other countries do to deter cartel behavior. The United States has, for a long period of time, forbidden or proscribed price fixing as a criminal offense. Section 1 of the Sherman Act, which is the American cartel law, forbids price fixing by both legal entities and by natural persons, and provides for both custodial sentences, that is to say, imprisonment, and also for fines. Violation is characterized under the case law as a per se offense, and injury to competition is presumed. Now, I'd like to pause for a moment and make sure that we all understand what I mean by a per se offense. U.S. law is quite different from community law in that regard. Those of you familiar with community competition law know that Article 81(1) proscribes cartel behavior, there is always recourse to Article 81(3) under community law. The United States has no equivalent in cartels of Article 81(3). The only question is whether the people agreed to fix prices. It is irrelevant whether the price fixing was successful or not. So going back to community law, the U.S. uses an object as opposed to an effect test. Let me give you an example. Several years ago, several dentists in Tucson, Arizona, agreed to fix the price that they charged for dental services. And the United States Department of Justice brought a criminal case against those few dentists. Now, in the city of Tucson, there are 463 dentists. It is inconceivable that three or four dentists who might have agreed to fix price could have had any effect on competition. Their numbers were so small. Nonetheless, that was an offense in the United States without regard to the success or failure of the cartel. There is no maximum fine in the United States, no maximum fine, and the maximum custodial sentence of imprisonment is 10 years. Let's move north. Canada has actually had an antitrust law for a longer period than the United States, and it also criminalizes price fixing. Article 45 of the Canadian Competition Act forbids price fixing and related conduct, and violation of the provision is an indictable offense. And recently, the Canadian Parliament has increased the maximum term of imprisonment from 5 to 14 years in prison. The maximum fine in Canada is some 14 million Canadian dollars. Historically, the cartel behavior in Canada was not a per se offense, and injury to competition had to be established. Canadian competition law had an equivalent of Article 81(3). On March 12 of 2009, a year ago, new legislation making cartel behavior per se illegal was passed by the Canadian Parliament. Ireland, where, as Don Pablo mentioned, I worked for some time, also has a criminalization of cartel conduct. The Competition Act of 2002 is a relatively new law, and it proscribes cartel conduct. It imposes liability on both legal entities, but also on natural persons. Jurisdiction in Ireland is vested in the Central Criminal Court rather than the traditional criminal courts. The Central Criminal Court has jurisdiction only for murder, rape, treason, and price fixing. In making that change, the Irish Parliament was presumably seeking to underscore the seriousness of price fixing by including it with murder, rape, and treason. The cartel provisions of the Irish law are modeled on those of the Treaty of Rome and permit consideration of an efficiencies defense. Upon conviction, individuals may be sentenced to a maximum term of 5 years imprisonment and fined up to 4 million euro. And I should note that the Irish authority has now obtained about almost 20 pleas of guilt. Most of them, the defendants have pleaded guilty, but in one case it was tried by a jury and the jury found the individual guilty. Moving to the United Kingdom, it became another jurisdiction to criminalize cartel behavior with the enactment of the Enterprise Act of 2002, which came into effect in June of 2003, and persons convicted of price fixing on indictment may be sentenced to up to 5 years imprisonment. There's no maximum fine. Other countries, too, prescribe cartel behavior. Brazil prescribes price fixing as a criminal offense, and if convicted, a person may be fined and sentenced to a term of 2 to 5 years imprisonment. Estonia prescribes price fixing as a crime and punishes it by a fine and a maximum term of imprisonment of 3 years. The Israeli trade practices law prescribes cartel conduct and permits the imposition of a maximum sentence of 5 years. The Japanese anti-monopoly law provides a fine and a maximum term of 5 years. Persons convicted of price fixing in Korea may be fined and sentenced to a maximum term of 3 years. And Russian law prohibits price fixing and prescribes a maximum 7-year term of imprisonment for individuals. And most recently, Australia has joined this small group of nations that characterize price fixing as criminal, and it also provides for imprisonment. Legislation was enacted into law by the Australian Parliament and received royal assent last June. The new law makes it offense and provides for imprisonment of up to 10 years. Several other jurisdictions provide for custodial sentences in limited circumstances. German law criminalizes bid rigging only, while the law of France theoretically criminalizes individual conduct where the individual has personally and fraudulently taken a crucial role in the conception or implementation of cartels and Some have characterized the Spanish law on price, on bid rigging as a criminal offense. But you know more about that than I. I should note that New Zealand government has just announced that it will seek consultation on how that country could criminalize cartel behavior. When I was just in Sydney a couple of months ago in Australia, I was interested when the New Zealand Competition Authority flew its members to Australia to meet to talk about their interest in criminalizing cartel behavior in New Zealand. And the South African Parliament is now taking up the issue of criminalization. Not long ago, I met with a judge of the Swedish Supreme Court and a legislator from Stockholm, indicating that Sweden, too, was thinking about criminalization. So, if we look at our world tour, it might suggest that there is a great focus on criminalization, and that imprisonment is really a fairly common sanction that is imposed. That conclusion, however, would be misleading, because the tour that I've just gone on does not reflect reality. The reality is really quite different from that which a reading of the law books might imply. For example, neither Estonia nor Russia have sentenced a single person to a custodial sentence. So while the law may say that one can go to prison, no one has. Irish judges have imposed custodial sentences, but then suspended the sentence in each and every occasion. No one in Ireland has gone to prison, except for one man last month who told the judge he refused to pay the fine that was imposed, and the judge said, well, in that case, I'll send you to prison. Japan has seen six individuals sentenced to terms of imprisonment, but the courts have suspended the sentences in each and every case. Likewise, Korea. In Korea, the courts have suspended all of the sentences for convicted cartelists. And Canada, while it has proscribed price fixing longer than any other country, has never sentenced someone to prison for price fixing, except in one case, and that case involved violence, where the perpetrator had committed violence against the competition. Brazil has sentenced 10 individuals to terms of imprisonment, but all of those cases are under appeal. So the reality is really very different from what the law books might suggest. While the laws of many countries provide for custodial sentences, most do not actually employ the custodial sanction. But the list of countries that have actually put individuals in prison for price fixing is not a null set. Israel, for example, has sentenced numerous convicted defendants to terms of imprisonment. Most were suspended, but seven individuals have actually gone to prison in Israel. And in the UK, which has a very new law, the UK courts have actually imposed sentences that have arisen under the Enterprise Act. Indeed, last June, the Crown Court sentenced persons to prison for 2 to 2.5 years. And so the UK has actually begun the imprisonment of cartelists. This slide shows where the home of one individual 2 years ago and his current home today in northern England. I remember this case particularly because I had been retained by their company to represent them, and I received a telephone call one morning from executives in England saying that they needed to contact the president and the vice president of the country, of the company. The DG Comp in Brussels were conducting a dawn raid all throughout England and and in Germany. And the OFT, the British authority, was also conducting a raid at the very same time in England. So you had a raid, a dawn raid by commission officials and a dawn raid by UK officials taking place at the very same hour. The company executives knew that the president and vice president were in the United States, and they wanted me to try to find them so that they could get direction on what should be done in light of the dawn raids that were taking place in Europe. I endeavored to find the executives and was sad to report that I had successfully found the executives and they were in a U.S. jail. It seems that executives from this industry, from Italy, Japan, Germany, the United Kingdom, had flown to the United States for a meeting, a trade association meeting. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, they had all been woken up by the police and taken in handcuffs to jail. It turns out that they had arrived for this trade association meeting on the prior day and that the authorities had filmed them together in a room fixing prices. And so we had a coordinated dawn raid in Japan, Korea, England, Germany, and the United States taking place at the very same hour. The executives of my company that I represented all went to prison and were the first individuals to go to prison under the British regime. The OFT has announced its intent to bring criminal charges in another case involving airlines, but we await future developments to see whether custodial sentences will become the reality in England. I think it fair to say that only the United States imposes significant custodial sentences with regularity. Table 1 shows the number of days of imprisonment by year for the past 10 years. And one can discern an obvious increase in recent years as the courts have become more willing to sentence executives to prison. Nonetheless, the number of days served even 10 years ago was not trivial when compared with the other jurisdictions that I mentioned a few moments ago. Moreover, the length of sentences has also increased, as this table illustrates. Now, it should be noted that these sentences were, for the most part, imposed prior to the time when the U.S. Congress increased the term from 3 years to 5 years. So we can anticipate the terms of imprisonment in the United States will be longer when sentences under the new law are actually imposed. Thus, only a very few countries actually put people in prison for price fixing, and only the United States has routinely imposed custodial sentences on convicted price fixers. Whether other countries will follow remains to be seen, but I argue that they should. And my thesis is as follows, in a nutshell. I assume that deterrence, that general deterrence, is the rationale for public antitrust sanctions, and that all competition authorities around the world are really interested in general deterrence, and that that is their objectives. I also assume that either fines or custodial sentences, if set appropriately, should at least in theory be able to provide the appropriate level of deterrence. But I argue that only custodial sentences are likely to be effective. Why? Because fines would have to be much higher than current levels to effectively deter. And I believe that such an increase in the level of fines is politically infeasible. Thus, the satisfaction of the deterrence objective is contingent upon the imposition of custodial sentences. To summarize, I believe that only imprisonment is likely to effectively deter cartel behavior. Now, the paper that I have made available was authored by my son and me, and someone might question why two lawyers who generally represent corporate interests should take this view. While price fixing sometimes reflects the policies of the most senior management, as it did in the London art auction cases, it is our experience that most cartel cases arise at middle management levels. And generally, such conduct takes place notwithstanding clear policies to the contrary and in the face of antitrust compliance programs in effect in those companies. Shareholders, indeed future shareholders, pay the fines for the past conduct of rogue employees who are often retired by the time the fines are paid. Since price fixing is always done by individuals, it seems most appropriate to focus deterrence on those who actually engage in cartel behavior. Now, I want to pause and admit that while there is a very rich economic and legal literature on substantive competition law, relatively little work has been done on competition remedies and on deterrence in particular. If we were talking about predatory pricing, there are volumes, almost libraries of research that have been done here in Europe and in the Americas on that subject. We could probably fill this whole room with articles and books that have been written by scholars on that subject. The same is not true with reference to remedies, and much work remains to be done. So any discussion of custodial sentences is handicapped by the absence of scholarly research on this subject. Nevertheless, what evidence we have suggests that monetary payments are unlikely to sufficiently deter cartel behavior and that custodial sentences are necessary. Now, as a theoretical matter, we ought always to prefer fines as a deterrence vehicle over custodial sentences. And the answer is obvious. Fines are obviously less costly to society. Fines generate funds for the exchequer, whereas custodial sentences impose a cost on the exchequer. Moreover, they are less intrusive and constrict individual freedom less. Unfortunately, several problems make fines much less effective than they might appear at first. Deterrence requires that the cartelist perceive that the expected benefits of price fixing are that the expected cost of price fixing, are outweighed by the expected benefits in order to deter. Assuming the benefit to the cartelist equals the amount of the price overcharge, divestiture of that overcharge ought to be required. If the cartelist retains a sufficient measure of the unlawful gain, the monetary penalty is essentially a license fee and will not deter. So in order to deter, you must force all price fixers to divest themselves of all of their ill-gotten gain, and that would optimally deter. But the reality is that competition authorities successfully identify and prosecute only a fraction of cartelists. The classic study by the economists Bryant and Eckert suggests that only 13 to 17% of price fixers are successfully identified and prosecuted. Thus, it is impossible for all price fixers to disgorge the fruits of their cartel conduct. Therefore, the fine must be increased to account for the probability of detection. The English philosopher Jeremy Bentham made this point centuries ago. So not only must those who are caught be forced to give up their ill-gotten gain, but that fine must be adjusted by the probability of detection and punishment. Now, we note that the research to date suggests that the current monetary sanctions are insufficient. When one goes to an ICN meeting or an OECD meeting or a Directors General meeting at the Commission in Brussels, one often sees charts like this. Indeed, this is a chart from the Commission, often used to show the success of the current cartel regime. And sometimes we see enforcement officials focus particularly on the vitamins cartel. Throughout Brussels, one will hear this case championed as the best evidence of the success of the European Union cartel enforcement program. Indeed, one can find numerous speeches by the former commissioner and the former director general saying that historic fines in the vitamins cases demonstrates the commission's serious commitment to fighting cartels. These cases, particularly the vitamins case, is seen by many as the star in the firmament of the EU enforcement policy. But the reality is really quite different. In the one serious study that's been done of the vitamins cases, Professor John O'Connor concluded that the monetary profits to the vitamins producers exceeded all of the penalties imposed, both the fines and the damage awards. O'Connor writes, "The total antitrust fines and penalties in the vitamins case are estimated to be at most $7.5 billion. But the best evidence of the cartel's monopoly profits were $9 to $10 billion. Thus, the criminal and civil justice systems around the globe fail to recover all of the cartel's illegal profits, much less account for the probability of detection and punishment." I don't think one can read these studies and conclude that the current policy is a success. Rather, I suggest to you, it is pretty patently a failure. So what is the solution? Well, at first blush, the solution might be, well, we need to raise the fines. I think that is also not correct. In an important contribution to the literature, Mr. Wouter Vils of the European Commission Legal Service concluded that European Commission's monetary penalties, that is to say its fines, would have to be in the range not of 10% of annual turnover, but 150% of annual turnover to deter. And he reached his conclusions by making the following assumptions predicated upon the data: a price increase of 10%, a profitability increase of 15%, a duration of the cartel of 5 years, and a probability of detection of 16%. Now, that study was done some time ago, early in this past decade. But work by other economists has since forced Mr. Vils to revise his estimates. And if we look at the latest work in light of the empirical research that's been done, we see Wouter Vils now assuming a price increase not of 10% but of 20%. I should note that this assumption is based upon an OECD study with 12 observations finding a median overcharge of 12.75%, but on a much more comprehensive study by Professor Connor that collected and analyzed 770 overcharges from cartels discovered over the past two centuries, and which concluded the median surcharge was really 25%. So Vils is using 20%. Also, a profitability increase of 10%, not 5%, in light of more recent work. Duration of the cartel remains the same, but the probability of detection is increased by virtue of the adoption of amnesty leniency programs in Brussels and in virtually every member state of the European Union, which has dramatically increased the success of enforcement. But even if one does the math again, one still comes up with the conclusion that fines would have to be dramatically higher, much higher than they are at present, to optimally deter. So, should we increase these fines to that level? Vils concludes that such a fine, and others who have studied it suggest that such a fine would exceed the ability of most defendants to pay. Indeed, one study done at the University of Amsterdam concludes that 60% of firms would be unable to survive the imposition of an optimally deterrent penalty without subjecting the company to bankruptcy. In other words, liquidation would result for many of these companies, and liquidation would impose cost on third parties, such as workers made redundant, reduction of the community's tax base, harm to suppliers and others. Essentially, this would be corporate capital punishment. And confronted with these externalities, no parliament anywhere is likely to embrace the required increase in fines to create an adequate deterrent. So simply the fines would have to be too high. There's another problem, though, and that's what I call the agency problem. Prices are fixed by people. Corporations, undertakings can't fix prices. Human beings fix prices. And as a OECD report concludes, agents of corporations commit violations of competition law. It makes sense to prevent them from engaging in unlawful conduct by threatening them directly with sanctions to impose such sanctions if they violate the law. Corporate sanctions alone present an agency issue. Managerial incentives are often different from corporate profit maximization. Bonuses and salaries associated with divisional performance, status, business travel, and power may be more important to managers. I recall from the British case that I put on the board when I interviewed the president and the vice president of my client as to why they had engaged in price fixing. They were part of a larger German conglomerate, and they said that they knew price fixing was illegal, but by the time anybody found it, they would be long gone. And in the interlude, they would have the benefit of the bonuses that would be paid to them by virtue of the success of their division. They would also have more power within the company, and more prerogatives would flow to them. So the fact that the company might face a fine, even a high fine, some years in the future, was irrelevant to them. So I suggest the focus ought to be on natural persons who engage in proscribed conduct. Now, that individual actors fix prices does not necessarily require custodial sentences. I mean, theoretically, one could have a properly set fine imposed on individuals. But such a fine actually presents, I think, real practical problems. First, courts are ill-equipped, commissions are ill-equipped to set such a fine because it requires what economists call individualized utility analysis. And even if it were feasible, most individuals would be unable to pay a fine, an efficiently deterring fine. And then lastly, it would be difficult to ensure that the fine was actually paid by the individual. A third objection to fines, admittedly less significant, is that sometimes the very victim of the cartel is saddled with payment of the fine. Fines and damages become a cost to the cartelist, which will be borne at least in part by future purchasers of the product. A dramatic example is the British public school case, or private schools. British schools in England that are called public schools are really private schools. And there, the OFT, the British Competition Authority, uncovered price fixing among these schools and levied fines. The fines, while nominally assessed against the school, were ultimately paid by the victims, payors of the tuition of the children who go to the schools. And for these reasons, first, because the fine would have to be too high, secondly, because it fails to focus on the individuals who actually engage in the fine, and thirdly, because the fine is actually, in most cases, paid at least in part by the victims, we think fines don't work. And rather, attention should be focused on custodial sentences. And I think the U.S. experience in that regard is informative. While price fixing has been a crime since 1980 in the United States, significant, routinely imposed custodial sentences are new. Although we can't prove the point, the incidence of domestic price fixing in the United States has declined since courts began to routinely impose non-trivial custodial sentences. Imprisonment is probably more abhorrent to the business executive than to the average criminal. As one prominent New York lawyer recently observed, he said, for the purse snatcher, a term of imprisonment may be little more unsettling than basic training in the army. To the businessman, however, imprisonment is the inferno, and conventional risk-reward analysis breaks down when the risk is jail. The threat of imprisonment, therefore, remains the most meaningful deterrent to individualized antitrust violations, and I think common sense suggests as much. As tables 1 and 2 demonstrate, the tables I posted on the screen a few moments ago, there has been both an increase in the length and the frequency of custodial sentences. There's further evidence that these sentences are having a dramatic deterrent effect. Focusing on the deterrent impact of U.S. sentences, the head of the criminal enforcement effort in the United States recently compared cartel activity in the United States and elsewhere. And he concluded that the best evidence of its impact is the fact that we have detected international cartels that fix prices everywhere around the world and except the United States. So get together and fix the prices in lots of places, but then agree that the price won't be fixed in the United States. They have avoided extending cartel activity to America, a lucrative market, because they fear detection and going to jail. These officials describe the decision to carve out the U.S. From a cartel, from the cartels of recent international experience. And I think that while anecdotal, this suggests that cartels were deterred from implementing their conspiracies in the United States, but undeterred from implementing the cartels elsewhere. My own experience as a defense lawyer suggests as much. When I take on a mandate from a client, my clients are always much more concerned about a criminal investigation than they are a civil or an administrative action. And while clients today increasingly insist that their lawyers live by budgets, at least in most cases, they seldom do so in criminal matters. When I have a matter in Brussels before the Commission, I find my clients are constantly asking me to keep costs down. But when I have a criminal matter, the clients are asking whether there's not something more that I could do. I think this difference in attitude, while unscientific, speaks volumes. And prosecutors tell a similar story. It's common for defendants in jurisdictions with custodial sentences to express a willingness to pay a higher fine in return for a reduction of time imprisonment, while the contrary is never the case. A recent working paper of the OECD Competition Committee in Paris put it this way: the prospect of spending time in jail will be the most powerful deterrent for business executives considering entering into a cartel arrangement. So what are the objections to criminalization? And again, I don't take up the legal issues, but rather, what are the normative objections to imposition of criminal sanctions? Well, three are sometimes voiced. First, it's suggested that the danger of false positives is simply too great. This criticism, I think, would have more traction if custodial sentences were imposed without sufficient safeguards to protect and ensure the rights of defense. However, those jurisdictions that impose such sentences do so within the context of their criminal process, which almost universally provide additional significant rights of defense. Second, it's argued that such penalties are inconsistent with social and legal norms. Proponents of this view argue that competition law is regulatory and not malum in se, to which I make two responses. Most jurisdictions today impose criminal sanctions on regulatory crimes, and the distinction, even if valid, does not preclude custodial sentences. But more importantly, price fixing is appropriately characterized as theft. Legislatures, parliaments have essentially created a property right in buyers, a property right in buyers to purchase goods and services free of collusion by sellers. When viewed as theft or fraud, I think it's appropriate to punish price fixing similar to other crimes like embezzlement. Recently, Mr. Justice McKechnie of the Irish High Court observed that cartel offenses are odious. He said, "They cause a transfer of consumers' money to themselves." The judge went on, "They are offensive and abhorrent not simply because they are malum prohibitum, but also because they are mala in se." Not that long ago, the former Director General of the British Authority, Sir John Vickers, put it this way: "Since hardcore cartels are like theft, criminalization makes punishment fit what is essentially a crime." And using similar language, the former Assistant Attorney General of the United States, Joel Klein, observed that price fixers are just well-dressed thieves. But lastly, some argue that increased rights of defense associated with criminal prosecutions render criminal cases more difficult to win than civil or administrative proceedings. And as a result, deterrence will not increase, but will diminish. This, however, is not true because of the additional rights of defense in criminal cases. It does not necessarily mean that the marginal prosecutorial costs exceed the marginal deterrent benefit. And I would suggest that the U.S. experience demonstrates that the additional costs associated with strong rights of defense are nonetheless outweighed by additional deterrent value. In summary, I believe that corporate fines do not adequately deter, and that an increase in such fines to an optimal level is not politically feasible. They would simply be too high. Moreover, crafting an optimally deterrent individual fine would be exceedingly difficult, if not impossible. Moreover, firms within concentrated industries with poor entry conditions may ultimately be able to pass on some or all of their fines to customers. Therefore, I would suggest that only custodial sentences are an appropriate sanction to provide deterrence to cartel offenses. Muchas gracias.
Thank you. Muchas gracias, señor Carvani, por su docta e ilustrada intervención. Si abre un periodo de coloquio, pues si alguien quiere formular alguna pregunta. ¿Sí?
Por favor.
Speaking about money, but if any of the parts of the cartel have the danger of a jail, could be more interesting in collaborate, and of this reason, the leniency plan with a danger of jail could be more efficient than today. That is only money. Are you agree or? What do you think about?
I think if you go to the Director General's meeting for the various member states in Brussels, you find people saying things that they would not say in public. I think that many Directors Generals of the various competition authorities have concluded that fines are not working. They're not working as well as they might, and there is an increased interest in custodial sentences, together with the leniency amnesty programs that you have discussed. And indeed, very senior officials at the Commission have thought that perhaps, at least in the short term, because the Commission does not have criminal competence, that you might see the combination of leniency and amnesty, which generates more cases, working together with the Commission's imposition of fines, and the member states, at least an increasing number of member states, imposing custodial sentences on individual behavior. So, for example, in the marine hoses case, you have Brussels, the Commission, undertaking an administrative case against the corporation, and the British Competition Authority undertaking a criminal case against the individual executives, all in the context of an amnesty application that was made by a Japanese company to the Commission that initiated the investigation. So I think a combination may see that happen. And I think that's aided by the fact that the British are actually putting people in prison. So that you may see cases involving the Commission on the one hand, but where there is an effect within the United Kingdom and their individuals in the United Kingdom proceed with criminal sanctions. And I should note that it's not just Gran Bretaña. You have Ireland, Estonia. The Swedes are talking about moving to criminal sanctions. And France and Germany have criminal sanctions that are not utilized. It's conceivable they may be utilized in the future. I hope that answers the question.
Más preguntas. Se admiten preguntas en español, por supuesto.
Thank you for your conference. After accepting a criminal sanction, there is a second step. The number of imprisonment years. Perhaps I'm very hard, but I'm not sure that 2 years imprisonment as average, two, three, four, five, is enough to deter people for price fixing. There is a big difference between among different countries. 5 years is the average, as far as I note it down. But for example, USA 10 years, Canada 14 years. And my question is the next one. What do you think about the average, the number of years in average to dissuade, to deter people before incurring in price fixing? Thank you very much.
That's a very good question. While I am in favor of prison sentences, I think the sentences in the United States and Canada and England are too high, because I think for a business executive, it can be a very short term. 1 year is probably sufficient. The marginal benefit of putting a business executive in prison for 10 years, I think, is very small. The business executives that I know who are used to riding in their own airplane or primera classe all the time with the car and the driver, going to prison even for a year is hell. I don't think the fines have to be high. I think the United States made a big mistake in increasing the fines. I think the Canadians made a big mistake. What's most important is that the executives go to prison for a period of time.
I hope you don't take my question amiss, but as you were doing sort of economic analysis on this, I'm wondering whether it wouldn't be very convenient for litigators if penal sanctions became common because, you know, as you said, there won't be any question of expenses on this sort of trial, so it would be a sort of lawyer's heaven, right?
Well, yeah. I think lawyers would probably benefit. I think that's right. I think you're right. There would be increased cost associated with the defense of individuals, and lawyers always seem to benefit when there's a problem. I think that nonetheless, custodial sentences are important and that they work. But I do take your point. That's, you know, in some sense, lawyers are like undertakers. They are looking for a good plague every now and then.
Insisto que se pueden hacer preguntas en español. Lucía.
Muchas gracias, director. La mía va en español.
Wait a minute, please.
Ah, thank you very much.
Un momentito, por favor.
All right.
Okay,
thank you. Aparte de los problemas que nos ha planteado en esta magnífica conferencia, ¿no cree, profesor, que también existe el grave riesgo, sobre todo en las grandes compañías, not speaking, not listening to me? Well, entonces lo intentaría hacer en inglés.
Un momento, por favor.
Okay,
well. Bien, aparte de los grandes problemas que nos ha planteado en la maravillosa conferencia que nos ha impartido, ¿no cree que también existe el riesgo, sobre todo en las grandes compañías, de que cuando existe, en los pocos casos en los que pueda existir, una sentencia condenatoria, no sea el verdadero responsable el que va a la cárcel? Thank you very much.
Thank you. I think that's a risk in any criminal case. I think any time you have a criminal case, you have a risk that you prosecute the wrong person. But I think that at least in most of the democracies today, there are very strong rights of defense in most countries, and we seem to be willing to live with those rights with the burglar, with the embezzler, with the robber, and I don't think it would be any different with the price fixer. So I guess I take your point, but I'm not that concerned about it. Thank you.
Más preguntas, por favor. Even in Spanish. No more.
Well, todos tienen hambre.
Todos tienen hambre. Well, gracias. Thank you very much on behalf of the regional government of Galicia and its School for Public Administration. Welcome to Galicia. Thank you for your conference. And we look forward to see you again as soon as possible. And you are in your home.
Thank you.
Free at home. Feel at home. Thank you very much. Agradeciendo la intervención de todos ustedes, la magnífica conferencia que nos ha impartido el profesor y abogado señor Terry Calvani. Quiero agradecer su presencia. En especial, me había olvidado de ellos. Pido disculpas. De los alumnos de la Escuela de Práctica Jurídica de Santiago y de su director, señor Lotario Vilaboy. Muchas gracias a todos y se levanta la sesión. Gracias.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Well, I hope an hour was okay. Is that okay? Not too short or too long? Or...
No. It's just the right time.
Thank you.